Not much time elapsed after King Hezekiah's foolish attempt to bribe the Assyrians before they invaded the kingdom of Judah in force. The effort to buy off the Assyrians by agreeing to such an exorbitant tribute payment that the temple itself had to be stripped of its gold, developed, as we saw last week, in the 14th year of Hezekiah's reign. The northern kingdom was by that time a fading memory. It fell several years before to the previous Assyrian king, Shalmaneser. Still, in the 8th century B.C., near the end of it now, the formidable Assyrian Empire resumed its march to world domination under the energetic leadership of a new king, Sennacherib. Now, to his credit, Hezekiah had bought some time, however little it was, by the agreement to pay tribute. Perhaps the king sensed that the little kingdom could not, in the final analysis, avoid a showdown with the Assyrians on the field of battle. At any event, we learn at the outset of this chapter concerning the events that followed hard on the invasion of Judah, of which we spoke in our last message. After these things, we read at the beginning of 2 Chronicles 32, and the establishment thereof. Now, those things in the context referred, of course, to the things that we read at the end of the previous chapter, where we read the words in particular, "In every work that he began in the service of the house of God, and in the law, and in the commandments to seek his God, he did it with all his heart and prospered." So these things of which we read in chapter 32 and verse 1 refer immediately in their context to his work of spiritual reformation. But they also come after those other things. The previous invasion of which we read last week in 2 Kings chapter 18. Now Sennacherib, we read here, renewed his campaign against the little kingdom south of the vanquished territory of Israel. And if the northern kingdom of Israel could not stop the Assyrians, there didn't seem to be much chance that the southern kingdom could do much against them. We don't read at all in the scriptural record about any regrets that King Hezekiah may have entertained about his previous policy. We don't know if he regretted having done what he did, but it is clear at the outset of this chapter that he understood that his kingdom could not avert, if it wanted to survive, a confrontation with the Assyrians after all. The struggle that was to ensue, as Hezekiah understood it, was to be for the survival of the country. But again, to his credit, King Hezekiah resolved that the kingdom would not perish without a determined fight. We read in this passage that there was a taking stock, if you will, of all the weapons that the kingdom had at its disposal, and the determination not to leave a single arrow in the nation's quiver, the situation was serious. Indeed, the king was in the vanguard in that trying time. He put his people and his army on the highest alert. I grew up in a military home, and we lived for 4 years almost on the frontier of the Cold War, and so we often heard the language of high alert. Hezekiah put his people and his army on high alert because Hezekiah was preparing for war. I want you to think upon that theme with me in the moments that we have this evening, preparing for war. Throughout history, the greatest tragedies have developed when nations have declined to face the obvious and have pursued foolish stratagems to keep the peace at all costs. During the 1930s, the world watched with growing alarm the war preparations of the Nazi regime under Adolf Hitler. Soft-spined politicians like the British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain were convinced that they could avoid a general war in exchange for giving to Hitler one small piece of territory that he required. It was known as the Sudetenland. It was a part of what was then Czechoslovakia, but it was a part occupied mainly by Germans. So they came to an agreement, and Chamberlain, flying back to England, got out of the plane with the signed paper in his hand, saying in a very memorable early film footage, "We have secured peace in our time." And so they failed, in spite of many voices of warning, they failed to prepare for the conflagration that was about to descend upon them. Hezekiah was not of that mind. There were steps that he and his kingdom could take, especially to strengthen the defensive capabilities of the capital city of Jerusalem. And they embarked on that strategy. And when we remember that the scriptures compare our lives in this world as part of a wide-ranging war between that which is right and that which is wrong, between good and evil, between Christ and the devil, then we too must be preparing for war and utilizing every defense that is available for this great battle, and every weapon of offense that is available as well. Now, when we look at this passage this evening, we find highlighted for us three particular aspects of the situation that enabled the people to prepare for that which was to come. First, the menace. The menace. Now, those who have not, for whatever reason, studied ancient history would find it hard to believe the reputation that the Assyrians had. But no one who lived in the Middle East during the 8th century BC could be ignorant of the ways of the Assyrians. If you had not experienced their ways personally, you would have heard about them. with their images of the winged bulls marking their battle standards and their palaces, they meant to intimidate every opponent into submission. The Assyrians had just one objective. It was very simple. It was conquest. And they wanted to conquer other peoples and other territories so as to increase the prestige of the Assyrian state and the wealth of the Assyrian state, whose capital was at Nineveh. The sheer ferocity of their methods of warfare and the cruel manner in which they treated their captives would remind people in more recent times of the butcheries of the 20th century, such as took place under Hitler or Stalin or Tojo of Japan or Mao Zedong of China. They were all guilty of deaths numbering in the tens of millions. Estimated Stalin was responsible for the deaths of 80 million people. Now, the Axis powers in World War II paid little attention to any restrictions on their barbarous cruelty, and people were terrified of them. In our time, such is the attitude toward the merchants of death who advanced the cause of Islam. Now, generally in America, not many people have seen the face of Islam up close. Some have, but not many have. But if you lived in other parts of the world, it would be a constant source of worry. Hezekiah knew about the Assyrians. He witnessed the steadfast manner in which they reduced the northern kingdom to oblivion. And he must have recognized the likelihood of a siege being mounted against Jerusalem. So it was that Hezekiah understood that he must get ready either for fighting, for battle, or for capitulation. Those were the options. Either you get ready to wage war to the extent of your ability to do so, or you capitulate. Now, those people who surrendered generally did not find very pleasant treatment, as the people in Samaria, the former capital of the northern kingdom, could have advised them. But here is the menace that confronts the people of God in so many areas. Will you plan for defense in the spiritual warfare? Or will you capitulate? Will you agree to surrender? There are a lot of people who argue that the trouble with churches today is that they don't find ways in which to get along with what's going on around them. That they don't find ways in which to capitulate. So that was the choice for Hezekiah. Are we going to get ready for war, or are we going to surrender? The people of Judah chose to fight. And that brings me to the second thing that we find in this passage, the resistance. So there's the menace, there's the threat, now the resistance. And we notice that the king and his princes and his mighty men, his chief advisors, these would be, that they met together and developed a careful strategy. Now in warfare, the strategy is the overall plan. The tactics deal with the particular details of that plan. So a strategy may encompass a wide focus, whereas the tactics may deal with a particular attack or a particular defense. What the king and his advisors wanted to do was to deprive Sennacherib and his forces of every possible resource on which they could draw in trying to reduce Jerusalem. And that's military language for overthrowing a city in a siege. So we notice here that the first objective of this strategy was to shut off the water supply to anyone outside the walls of the city. Notice in verse 3, he took counsel with his princes and his mighty men to stop the waters of the fountains which were without the city. And they did help him. So there was gathered much people together who stopped all the fountains. We can understand those to be springs of water. And the brook that ran through the midst of the land, saying, why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water? So their first objective was to deprive the Assyrians, when they would come, of water, which they would need. And we notice here that they enlisted the help not only of the chief advisors to the king, but they enlisted the help of the people of Jerusalem on what was a major project of civil engineering. And here is what it entailed. What the people envisioned was not so much plugging the springs, because those things could be easily reversed, but they proposed a way in which to divert the water of the stream, the brook, of which we read here, that ran through the city, so that the water would not flow to the springs outside the city walls, but that it would be redirected within the city walls. And to do that, they fashioned a conduit. And if you can look up the conduit that Hezekiah built, it's still there today. It shows you something about the quality of what they did. But they've made a conduit under the walls so they could divert the water. So that they made a channel. They made a new channel that would be a means of diverting water, keeping it from flowing under the walls and outside the city to the springs out there. And they fashioned not only this conduit, but they fashioned also a reservoir, a pool, where the water would go, a place where the water could be stored so that they could use it in the coming siege of the city. Now, as I say, the area of the city of Jerusalem is on a slope. Jerusalem sits on a high place, and it is on a slope so that the water in this stream would flow down through the city and then out down the slope, out under the walls, and out into the area down below. So by building this conduit and this pool, they diverted the water so that it stayed inside the city. That pool later came to be known as the Pool of Siloam. And it was a pool to which the Lord Jesus Christ himself referred during his public ministry. So the motive that they had in this elaborate project, and there's no telling how long this project took, because obviously they didn't have the kinds of excavation equipment that we would employ today. So much of the digging, no doubt, had to be done by hand tools. And it took a lot of energy. So they wanted to prevent the Assyrians from having the water, and at the same time, they wanted there to be a constant supply for the people in the city. That was vital to defending in a siege. So that was one part of the plan. The next part of the plan was, as we find in verse 5, that the king strengthened himself and built up all the wall that was broken and raised it up to the towers and another wall without and repaired Millo, that was a fortress in the city of David, and made darts and shields in abundance. So the king looked at the state of the city's defenses, its wall, and directed that those fortifications should be repaired. Places where the wall had decayed, where it was broken down, he directed that it be rebuilt, because doing so would make the city harder to attack by direct assault. So the king directed that, the rebuilding of the man-made defenses, if you will. And then he also directed that there should be fresh additions to the national armory, to the arsenal of weapons. And you find that at the end of verse 5, the making of darts and shields, notice this, in abundance. So they weren't looking to disarm. They were looking to increase their capability offensively. The darts would correspond in our thinking to arrows that could be shot from the walls of the city, and possibly to spears. And the shields, of course, were the individual weapons of defense, the individual fortifications. So there you have, first of all, the emphasis on the water and what they had to do there. So you see that the preparations for war were extensive, required tremendous energy and concentration. And then the creation of weapons, ammunition, if you will, to be used in the war. But there was another part of this resistance, of which we read here, that was just as important, and that was the human component. And so we read in verse 6 that he set captains of war over the people. That is, he reorganized the army and used the captains in the army and formed the people into militia companies, however you want to call them. And that was so that the people then could participate in their own defense. And so he urged them, as we find here in verse 7, to be strong and courageous. So here was the resistance. Hezekiah said, we're not going to surrender. We're not going down without a fight. We're going to wage war against the Assyrians. But there was one last part of this preparation for war that he knew he could not neglect. And that brings us to the refuge. The refuge. And it is striking that the king spoke comfortably to the people, as we see in verse 6, but the words that he used were set really in spiritual terms. That is, he said to them, don't be afraid. Don't be dismayed. Now, the king of Assyria counted on people being dismayed, and we're going to see that as the campaign would unfold, they would engage in that very approach of trying to intimidate the people. But Hezekiah said, no, don't be dismayed for the king of Assyria, nor for the multitude that is with him. It would be easy to say, we're hopelessly outnumbered. So they were. Judah was a little country. Assyria was a mighty empire, which had apparently limitless resources, although it would disappear from the world scene within 100 years after this time. They had a mighty reputation. They had an imposing army. It would be natural to be afraid of them. But Hezekiah said to the people, don't look at them. Look at the Lord, your God. So you find that in verse 7 at the end, he said to them, there be more with us than with him. Now, how could he say that? The people of Judah could count. They could look out when the Assyrians would appear, and they could tell there are a lot more of them. But it was like the incident with Elisha and his servant when they were surrounded by the Syrian army. And the servant said, alas, my master, what shall we do? And Elisha said, don't be afraid. There are more with us than with them. And he asked the Lord to open his eyes. And the Lord opened his eyes, and he saw the invisible host, that the hills were full of the forces of the Lord. So it was now with Hezekiah, asserting this truth. There are more with us than with them. And we read that his words electrified the people. He said to them in verse 8, with him is an arm of flesh. Oh yes, they've got the soldiers. And they don't care how many they lose. They have plenty more to put in their place. With him is an arm of flesh. But with us is the Lord our God to help us and to fight our battles. So here were people who knew that the existence of their country was at stake. But they believed God. They looked to the Lord their God. So here was Hezekiah, really, this was the great thing about him, was that he could direct the people to the Lord because he knew the Lord himself. They believed in the Lord their God. Notice how he puts it in verse 8. With us is the Lord our God to help us and to fight our battles. There were prophets who had exhorted previous kings, believe in the Lord your God. So shall you prosper. And the people, we read here, relied, they rested on the words of Hezekiah. And they sensed that the way of victory was at hand. They didn't know how it was going to come about. And when I think of them here, I think of the people of God today. Because ultimately, what we hear in these words is the voice of Christ himself exhorting us not to be intimidated by the opposition that we face in the spiritual warfare, but instead to be strong and courageous. That was the word that was given to Joshua by Moses. Be strong and courageous. It was the word that Joshua received from the Lord after Moses was dead. Be strong and of a good courage. Why? Because the Lord your God is with you. We think about our Lord Jesus Christ. What a powerful example he has set for us in the spiritual warfare, even in the places of great anguish and agony. He still rested in the Lord, in the Father. And today, we hear that same counsel. Be strong and courageous in the spiritual warfare. Christ is our captain. We look unto him. We are certain of his triumph. And as he has organized his people for the war, he has assured every one of us there's no retreat, there's no capitulation, there's no surrender. The work of God goes forward. And we rejoice tonight that as Hezekiah prepared for war, so the Lord calls us to be on guard day and night in the warfare to which the Lord himself has called us. There are many who have already laid down their weapons and have gone into the presence of our Lord. But those who are left behind are still engaged in the battle. And so they will be as long as there is breath in their bodies. He prepared for war. There was a great menace, but there was strong resistance and confidence in the place of refuge. Let us follow that example and trust in the Lord, our God.